Of the House Hess and Social Services Committee will now come to order. It is 3:03 on Tuesday, February 6th, in room 107. Members present are Rep. Eastman, Keto, Sullivan, Leonard, Johnston, and myself, Rep. Sponholz. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business today. Please take the time to silence your cell phones during the duration of this meeting. Before we begin, I want to thank Carber, the House Hess Secretary from Records, and Kelsey Goodell from the Juno LIO for staffing the committee today. We're going to be hearing a presentation from the Department of Health and Social Services discussing the findings and recommendations regarding the study of privatizing Alaska Psychiatric Institute. Dr. Randall Burns, I believe, Director of the Division of Behavioral Health and the Study Consultants, will be presenting, and I'd like to just ask them to come forward at this time. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Randall Burns, the Director of the Division of Behavioral Health, and even though I may look like it, I'm not a doctor.
Well, you know, I just gave you a little promotion there, huh?
Thank you very much. We also have on the phone representatives from Public Consulting Group to really go through the slides, but before we start, I would just like to introduce Coy Jones. He's the program lead for this project, and he's on the phone, and he'll introduce the other staff that are there. So in the interest of time, I'll just turn it over to Mr. Jones to start, if you don't mind.
Thank you, Mr. Burns. Yeah.
All right, this is Coy Jones. I'm a consultant at PCG, and I was the project lead for the privatization feasibility study. I have with me on the line as well Edwin Roby and James Waldinger with PCG. I'll be doing most of the talking, but in case they need to interject, they'll state their name for the record too. Thank you for allowing me to present some of our findings and recommendations. My understanding is that you have a copy of the presentation in front of you. I'm going to go through it, and I believe Director Burns will be doing the slide work. So I'll just let you know what slide I'm looking at. Very briefly, there's a lot of detail in the report. It drills down pretty deep levels. I'm going to keep it at a very high level of just kind of overall findings and recommendations. But I want to talk a little bit about our methodology, and since we're dealing with a lot of hypothetical sorts of things, I want to be very clear about the assumptions that we use in our feasibility study. So I do want to spend a little bit of time going into detail about that, and then to give our overall recommendations about a lot of the options that we reviewed. If we could start on slide four. We spent quite a bit of time in Alaska in different areas of the state with stakeholders both in government and in the private sector with former patients, former employees of API, other sorts of stakeholders within the industry. We spent time in Anchorage, Juneau, Fairbanks, in the Mat-Su Valley. We talked to a lot of not only stakeholders in government, but many behavioral health providers, both the community providers as well as a lot of the hospitals who work very closely with API, both in the Anchorage area as well as in the other regions that I mentioned. We also spoke pretty significantly with two of the three labor unions that were affected, as well as trade associations in Alaska. So aside from all the stakeholder feedback that we gathered, we also did some fairly extensive studies of privatization efforts that have happened within the last 10 years throughout the country, seeing if there's any kind of lessons learned or best practices from similar efforts that we found in other states. In addition to that, we also did a literature review of privatization efforts in kind of relevantly similar situations. So not necessarily psychiatric hospitals, but general hospitals, as well as prison privatization. I don't go through that today, but I just wanted to kind of flag that those other sorts of studies can be found in the report. And there are some important lessons learned that inform, some of the judgment calls that we make in our recommendations. Moving on to slide five, this slide just kind of presents our full range of options. So we didn't consider privatization in just one way, that it's either or, it's private or public. There are lots of different ways that you can think about privatization and slice it up. So we identified four major options, and then there are some sub options in there too. I'll just kind of take you through the highlights. The first that we considered is kind of the classic case. It's the full privatization. Our understanding from the contract and the conditions of the study was that there was not interest in selling API, either the property or the facility, but that would stay in the hands of the state. So when we say full privatization, the conditions there are that a private entity would either serve as a property manager or they would lease the facility. But other than that basic retention of ownership, all operations at API would be privatized. So that's option one. Option two is just a slight variation of full privatization. It assumes that the state would partner with a private entity and form an entirely new legal entity through a joint operating agreement, and that could be implemented either as a kind of a new hybrid public corporation, sort of along the lines of the mental health trust, but it would be a public corporation with some private partners on the board, or you could do this in a more traditional way, which is just a 501c3 private operator operating as a joint operating agreement. There's a lot of operatings. A joint operating agreement, and there are multiple ways that you could do that. That option is not very distinct from the first option in terms of its financial impacts or its service delivery impacts. So whenever I'm speaking of option one, that also applies to option two. But we didn't want to differentiate those because they have, slightly different kind of legal statuses. Option three is really not a privatization option. It's an alternative to privatizations. One of the things that we were, part of our scope was to look at efficiencies that could be found, both in terms of cost and service delivery within the present management structure. And so we're calling that continued state management with new efficiencies. So what sorts of efficiencies that a private operator might bring to API that you could also do on some kind of a public umbrella? And then the fourth option is also a set of privatization options. We're calling it component outsourcing, and it's really just privatizing pieces, fairly discrete and easy to break out pieces of API's operations that a private provider might be able to do. And we identified kind of four discrete pieces. One is the communication center at API. That's really kind of the reception and security functions of API. So it's the front desk, and it's kind of the basic security around there of monitoring who goes in and out and being that front door of API. It's not a big piece of the hospital, but currently they're public employees, and that's frequently privatized, and we wanted to explore what the privatization options would be for that. We also looked at other indirect service components at the hospital, such as just maintenance and environmental services. We ruled out all those different components up into one, and we're just calling it facility and materials management, outsourcing those functions. And then we looked at some of the more core direct care functions at the hospital. So we looked at the possibility of privatizing the physician services there, both psychiatrists and as well. There are some other medical physicians. There are some medical services that are also offered at API. We're just looking at what would it mean to privatize all the physician staff. And then option 4D is looking at that at all the nursing staff. So the registered nurses, the RNs, as well as their support staff, the psychiatric nursing assistants, PNAs. And then our final option was really taking all of those together, and we're calling it comprehensive outsourcing. What would it mean in that option? We're essentially looking at what the implications are of outsourcing everything but the basic administration and management of the hospital. So that's what comprehensive outsourcing represents. Okay, moving on to slide 6, I want to turn a little bit to the different kinds of financial and service delivery assumptions that went into our cost benefit analysis and our privatization models. Looking at some of the basic kind of operational cost assumptions, when it came to capital costs, we assumed that those would remain basically the same under any kind of privatization option. Depending on who the operator is, it doesn't really matter in terms of the cost of maintaining the facility. So those remain the same, whether they're in column A or column B. We also have some assumptions about the different kinds of profit or margin that you would expect from a not-for-profit versus a for-profit. For our for-profits, we assume that there would be a kind of an 8% expectation of profit. That figure comes from many RFPs that for-profit entities have submitted for psychiatric hospital privatizations like this. 8% is a pretty standard figure. And then not-for-profits often operate, they still operate with some level of margin, but that's usually closer to 4%. In terms of salary and benefits, the common knowledge is that there's savings to be gained from privatization. It's usually because the compensation looks significantly different under a private entity than it does a public entity. And we found that to be the case in the major example of a successful privatization effort in Florida. South Florida State Hospital is one of the few psychiatric hospitals in the U.S. that has been completely privatized. We had access to the financial information of that hospital as well as its sister hospitals that are under state management. So it was really a great case to see what a private provider would do relative to what its salary would pay, what they pay in salary versus a public employer, as well as how the benefit structure is different. So what we saw there, which we applied to our model, was that the salaries of employees would increase under a private entity. We saw about 13.7%. So they're paid 13.7% more, but the benefits decreased significantly largely because public employees, especially Alaska, have pretty generous retirement benefits and other sorts of benefits. Currently, about 36% of total compensation for API employees on average comes from their benefit package. In Florida, on a private provider, it's 19%. Looking at the different cost profiles of Alaska, we estimated that benefits would probably be more like around 22% under a private employer. Under privatization, there would be some legal costs that the private employer would have to have currently the state, they're not internalized to API currently. The API relies on the Department of Law and lawyers and the rest of the state government. So we added some additional costs around legal costs. They're not significant, but they're there. We believe that a private employer would manage overtime expenses a little differently. So we did estimate that there would be some reduction in the use of overtime, and then a full-time employee under state rules currently is about 37.5 hours a week, and then you start paying overtime. Under a private FTE would be 2080, it would be a 40-hour week. So there would be some differences in overtime pay that would affect the private model. Turning to slide 7, there are also, in addition to those kind of operational assumptions, there were some specific transition cost assumptions that we were interested in. One, a big one is around IT. So currently, API is in need of an upgrade of its electronic medical record system. If it's not already out of compliance, the Meditech system will be out of compliance soon, and the state is looking at a $2.1 million price tag to upgrade that. We employed a kind of an optimistic assumption that a private entity would come in with their system and they could simply absorb those costs, those wouldn't be new costs there. So we didn't apply that $2.1 million under a private entity, but we did apply it under continued state management and as the baseline for comparison. There will also be some additional liabilities to the retirement fund in the case of privatization. We talked to the Department of Administration about this based on some similar kinds of analyses they've done with other hospitals in the state. They projected that it would be around $2 million in termination liability, which we applied to our models. And then we also saw that there would be some additional contract monitoring costs. The role of the state would really fundamentally change from providing the direct service to making sure that it's being, delivered appropriately by a private entity. So there would be some new expertise that would have to be developed. Looking at the literature on what procurement and contract monitoring costs are in privatization, that's often very hard to quantify. But the literature says that it's often around 20%, and different studies vary between about 14 to 20%. Our estimate is that additional contract monitoring costs would be around 15% of the total contract costs. So that's also built in as an additional cost under privatization. When it comes to the revenue assumptions, keeping in mind that API is not all cost. There are some sources of revenue through private insurance and disproportionate share hospital funds from the federal government and Medicaid claims and those sorts of things. We looked at whether there would be major differences in revenue. We didn't see anything that would point to significant shifts in how the hospital makes its money under a private entity versus a public entity. Unlike a general hospital, there's not a lot of profitable lines. Like, you're not going to put in a maternity ward or anything like that that would generate more revenue. So our revenue assumptions are essentially that the revenue would stay the same in a public or private entity. Moving to slide 8, we're turning from the financial assumptions to some of our service delivery assumptions. The question really is, how many staff do you need to make sure that you're maintaining decent service delivery? And also addressing the question, is API understaffed or overstaffed currently? Would it need more people or less people? Our sources of information on trying to determine those questions came often, in many places, from stakeholder comment, people who are close to API, who have some insight and window into its operations and what's being done well and what's being done poorly. We're fortunate to have a set of very recent clinical reviews where outside consultants have come in to look at how nursing and things like that operate and have offered critical comments and pointed out potential inefficiencies. And then in a set of limited cases, there are industry best practices about, like, how many RNs do you need in a psychiatric hospital setting. So we were able to rely on staff ratio guidelines in the case of RNs, at least. So the And in addition to that, we also had a wealth of information about peer state hospitals. So looking at similar state hospitals in other states, API doesn't have really any true peer because of the, as you all know, the uniqueness of Alaska. But there are states where there's, you know, one hospital that serves the entire state. It, it's high acuity, acute care, that allowed, and small. And that those allowed us to make some kind of comparisons.
Mr. Jones?
The stakeholder interviews and the clinical reviews allowed us to really, you know, dig deep and find particular areas where there's potential inefficiency. And
hey,
we saw,
Coy.
We heard a lot of similar comments.
Coy?
Mr. Jones?
Yes.
This is Chair Sponholz. I just want to acknowledge that we have about 7 minutes left in our time before we must adjourn this committee because we have a finance subcommittee hearing at 3:30. So I just want to acknowledge that. I don't want to ask you to rush through the remaining approximately 17 slides in the next 8 minutes or 7 minutes. I don't think that gives this the time that it merits. And so what I'd like to ask both Mr. Burns and Mr. Jones is if we could continue through to our, you know, natural stopping point at 3:30 and that you come back again on Thursday at 3 p.m. It's got to, oh, never mind. It's got to be Tuesday, next Tuesday at 3 p.m. Is that possible?
Madam Chair, sure.
All right, so we'll plan on getting back together on Valentine's Day, February the 14th at 3 p.m. to finish this study. So let's continue, Mr. Jones. Thank you.
Okay. And it goes a little more quickly. but if needed, we can make it back on Tuesday. Turning to slide 9, this presents some of the different staffing ratios. We found, looking at the API baseline, which is the middle column, that's the way the API is kind of staffed, at least in fiscal year 15. And it does not resemble most state hospitals, that large peer group. It's closer to small peer group hospitals. But as you can see, when you compare the large peer group and the small peer group, API has a higher staff-to-patient ratio in just about all categories. That suggested that there are potential areas where API is overstaffed and where cuts are plausible and possible. This peer state analysis and comparison combined with specific areas where we heard stakeholders identify potential places for cuts, we made reductions there, hypothetical reductions, and then compared what it would look like. And it turns out API begins to look a lot closer to small peer groups in all areas. What we found is that in direct services, API, if we made the reductions that we suggest, API would look almost exactly like the small peer group hospital. And under a privatized scenario, it would have lower kind of administrative staffing, which is consistent with what you would imagine from a private entity where there's a kind of a larger corporate enterprise with things like IT, quality assurance personnel, and some financial personnel, that could be absorbed within the larger corporate enterprise. So this table shows that under recommended privatized staffing, you would have slightly lower overall staff to patient ratios than in a state managed system. But even under state managed recommendations with new efficiencies, API would come much closer to what the small peer groups would look like. Small state hospital peer groups. So turning to slide 10, talk a little bit about where we made the suggested reductions. In administrative costs, we found reductions related to IT for some of the reasons that I mentioned before, that there would be a corporate enterprise that could absorb some of these things. Our assumption here is that API could run at least at the staffing, administrative staffing ratio of other small hospitals, and then under a private entity, you could cut even a little more deeply. In nursing, we assume that API could operate with staffing nursing staff levels that were comparable to small peer hospitals. We calculated what it would require to have the kind of the minimum staffing on the floor. You know, there are different wings of API, and you need a minimum number of staff at all times. And there are some patients that require close observation status, where we're talking about one-on-one, maybe even two-on-one nurse-to-patient ratios, depending on the severity of the person's symptoms and diagnosis. API is very good at tracking close observation status, so you, over the course of a year, you can know really how many extra nurses and nursing staff you need. So looking at that, we found that you would need at any given time about 18.1 nursing staff on the floor. Our recommended models suggest about 21.2 nursing staff. So there's a little extra slack in there from the bare minimum, but not a lot of slack. I just want to note that the task of our model was to kind of predict what a contractor would do, not necessarily what they should do. Our recommended staffing we consider safe, but we don't necessarily consider optimal because a private provider is not necessarily going to optimize staff. They're just going to make sure that it's safe.
Mr. Jones?
Yes.
This is at, we're sort of at a sort of a natural pivot point in your presentation. We have a 1 minute left, and I wanted to give the committee an opportunity to ask any questions before we wrap up the committee today. Is there any questions for Mr. Jones? Representative Johnston.
Yes, thank you, Chair. And I know that your assigned task was for privatization. Have you ever, in your other research, ever looked at the managed competition model for something like this? Are you familiar with it?
I have not looked at that other model.
The reason I mention it, I just noticed with your scenario, scenario three, finding efficiencies, and then just as you separated things out, a managed competition by bidding for certain services have a built-in managed competition. Well, sometimes you find out that the body that is currently providing the service becomes more efficient just as they put together a bid to see if to bid against others. So I was just curious.
Okay.
Sure. Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, through the chair. My question is this. In the aspect of looking to see whether API could be privatized or not, was there maybe a dollar amount to show how much the state would save if API did go private?
Yes, we did have some very detailed cost-benefit analyses financially as well, and those are detailed in the report. I didn't put them here on the slide because, you know, clearly it's easy to get bogged out in a lot of this information. But so for each of the options, we do, based on our models, list a dollar figure of what the total saved or increased, and then how that's reflected in the state general fund as well.
Okay, and you can provide that to us then, sir?
The full privatization report was actually sent out to all members of this committee. We can re-forward that for everybody as well.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So I had a question as it relates to, could you describe a little bit, this is Chair Sponholz, the difference between large peer groups and small peer groups. Could you go into that a little bit more so that we understand kind of the context?
Sure.
The comparisons.
So many hospitals have, you know, maybe 200 beds, some as high as 800 beds. So when you have those kinds of sizes, you're able to make do with much smaller administrative ratios to the number of beds. You need to buy one. Your IT system costs the same whether you're 80 beds or 500 beds, but that's a much more significant cost if it's a small hospital relative to the size of the operation. And then, in some cases, you can, because of that size, you can also rely on your direct care. You can have economies of scale even on the direct care side of things. Now, when you're dealing with a small hospital, you're going to have a greater amount of administrative overhead, and most likely your small hospital is going to focus either on some kind of very specialized service, or it's going to have a focus on very like acute emergency services. Whereas a large hospital is going to have a range of services and take care of a lot of different sorts of patients, not many of which are not nearly as intensive as API. So looking at the cost profile, you'd say, well, this cost per bed at the hospital, the large peer hospitals, is really, you know, really small. Well, that's because they're not necessarily taking care of folks of you know, the significant kind of severity that like API would take care of. So we did want to separate out the large hospitals from the small hospitals to recognize, A, those very big differences in economies of scale, and then, B, to recognize that there are particular acute services and that the small hospitals are much closer in the kinds of care and the kinds of patients they have to API than the big ones do.
Is there any other questions for Mr. Jones before we wrap it up for the day? All right, then I am going to, the time is 3:34. The hearing of House Health and Social Services Committee is now adjourned for the day. House Finance Subcommittee will begin in about 1 minute to give time for the changeover. Thank you.